It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We examine the complexities of grandparents raising their grandchildren. The nonprofit advocacy group Generations United, it cites nearly 8 million children live in households headed by grandparents or other relatives. Be part of this conversation. Call in with a question. Share comments at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Judy Dysock is a grandmother raising her grandchild and a participant in the group called Grandparents Raising Grandchildren Peer Support Group in Waukesha. Judy, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you very much. It's my pleasure.
Good morning. Linda Senger here as well, licensed social worker and organizer of the Waukesha group. Linda, welcome.
Good morning, Kate. Thank you for having me.
Linda, let's start with you. You started this support group 5 years ago for grandparents raising their grandchildren, and it's served hundreds of people in the process. Why did you form this group?
Well, Kate, we started in 2018. I'm an ongoing child protective social worker for Waukesha County, and I deal with kids who are placed outside of the home due to abuse and neglect. And we've seen, at that point, we've had grandparents caring for grandkids ongoing basis. I've been doing this for 32 years, and it's not a new thing. But the numbers have grown exponentially. And in 2018, we decided that it was time that we provide some additional support to the grandparents. Having grandkids placed is different as being a placement option, very different than being an aunt or an uncle or a cousin agreeing to take in a child, because the dynamics are so very different. Oftentimes it's the biological adult child who's been not be able to raise their children. And we ask the grandparents to step it up. But a great need, and the grandparents really needed support from our department as well as from each other and learning from each other. So there's a lot of dynamics that go with it, but we felt the need was really obvious and we had to do something. So that's why we put this together.
Judy, this is personal for you. Your granddaughter has been in your care since she was 5. You adopted her at age 8. What has the support group meant for you?
Well, it's been a lot of interesting things that happen. People tell their stories. They come in and they tell their stories. And it usually in the beginning, when one arrives, one is pretty shaken up and discombobbled because people have never anticipated this in their lifetime, especially those of us who are retired. And then there are younger grandparents who have jobs and they need to be able to vent to people who understand because they've gone through it or are going through it. My husband and I and another couple and Linda were the founders of the group. And so in the beginning, it was everybody was discombobbled, as I said, crying, telling the stories because it's very personal and you don't know what to do. You don't know where to go. And so as we started to do this, we found there was a lot of healing in it. And then more people came. And the people who originally were there were able to help those people. And so the cycle goes on. It's been very good from the standpoint of, I think the best thing is that you know that somebody else is in the same spot and you know where to go and you can listen and learn from each other.
How is your granddaughter doing, may I ask?
Excellent. Mm. She's doing super. She's in seventh grade. She's 12 now. She's doing very, very well. One of the things I always say has helped and certainly would tell other people is counseling is a good thing to do. Mm. The child has someplace to go to another adult to be safe. Every one of these children has a different take on life, shall we say. Mm-hmm. And they have difficulties. Disabilities, they already are at risk because of the situation. And the abandonment that they feel is deeply set. So it's something to deal with all the time. And then you have to deal with usually the parent of the child who happens to be your child.
Mm.
And that gets a little complicated. And so guidance is always helpful in that way. That's also something that we might talk about within the group. But it's tricky and complicated. But she's doing well, and thank you for asking.
Yes, Judy Dysock there is a grandmother and a participant in the Waukesha Support Group for Grandparents Providing Care. Linda Singer with us, organizer of this group as we talk about care grand families in Wisconsin. You can join in with your questions and your experiences, your thoughts, 800-642-1234. Linda, what are the complexities and the biggest barriers that grandparents face when starting to care full-time for that grandchild? You mentioned the placement has complexities for you as a social worker.
Yeah. And again, we have our members of our group come from different places. Certainly, many of the grandparents we work with, their grandkids were placed through Waukesha County Juvenile Court due to protection and safety concerns. But we have other members, they have a voluntary placement with their grandkids. Some have, we do have folks who have guardianship through kind of the formal measures through our system, but some have gotten guardianship out privately. Mm-hmm. And it kind of all varies. For folks in our system, just going through the juvenile court process is, it's a lot. It's a process they're not familiar with, and they have to be licensed as a level one foster home and a lot of different steps. For those who are not in the formal court system, we've learned over time, many of them have these kids. They may have a private guardianship. They have no clue as to benefits that they're eligible for, resources. They're just doing it by the skin of their teeth. They have no clue. Mm-hmm. So a big thing that we've learned over time is the need to provide information to grandparents, again, in Waukesha County, who are not involved in the system, and they need to understand the resources that are available. We have many grandparents have come through our door. They've been going through the retirement funds to pay for daycare, to pay for basic cares of their grandkids. Not what they had planned for. They had planned to go and retire and be in Hilton Head, and instead they're, or some other warm place, but they are using their resources to raise their grandkids. And there are a lot of resources that are available to them, but they have no idea. So education is real key, hooking them up with resources and different programs that will make their lives a little bit easier, as well as helping out the grandkids. So it's complex.
I wonder, Judy, at the support group, do grandparents talk about their age and their capacity to be able to raise a child for years to come? I mean, what happens if they fall ill or have an accident?
Well, that is always something that we think about.
Mm.
And there are a variety of ages that are there. Yes, we have. And the nice thing is that Linda, you know, has provided for us speakers who come in. And one of them recently were lawyers who could help us to set up wills and do that sort of thing, because we do have to think about that. And it is always looming out there, especially for those of us who are probably the oldest in the group, and I won't mention any names. it is something that we think about and we do discuss. Yes, absolutely.
Judy Dysock and Linda Singer with us. They're active in the Grandparents Raising Grandchildren Support Group in Waukesha. Be part of this discussion about grand families. Call in with a question. Share your perspectives along the way. 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.
We'll be right back.
It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. We discuss resources in Wisconsin for grandparents raising grandchildren, including support groups and financial assistance. Judy Dysock is part of the group Grandparents Raising Grandchildren in Waukesha. Linda Sanger is organizer of the group and a licensed social worker for Waukesha County Health and Human Services. Call in with a question or comments, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Linda, you say some families who adopt grandchildren avoid sharing their circumstances with school. They avoid sharing their circumstances with the acquaintances around them. Why is that?
Well, I think specifically, if I could talk about the kids first, often kids who are placed with grandparents, either just a temporary physical custody order through juvenile court, a guardianship, or even an adoption, which is less frequent, but we have grandparents who adopt. The kids are the outsiders, especially in the school system. They're being raised by grandparents. Their friends are raised by their biological parents, and they're younger and all this stuff, and they kind of stand out. And so I have had many kids that I work with, even on my caseload, they keep it. They just stay, I'm just staying with my aunt and uncle for a little while. They'll make up stories. They're not comfortable with the situation. They have alliances with their and feelings about their parents. They're in a tough spot. So some kids will just make up stories to try to fit in. And as they get more comfortable, and that's going to be their reality, they're going to basically be raised until they're adults with their grandparents. As they become more comfortable, therapy helps. Kids are more inclined to speak about it. If I could just say a cool thing about our group is we meet again once a month, but the kids are a part of that.
Oh.
We have dinner together, and then we work with the past couple of years working with Healing Hearts. The adults meet, and the kids will do activities with the Healing Heart volunteers. And in that, the kids are making friends with other kids living the same situation they are. It is just a cool thing, the friendships that have developed amongst the kids. And to be honest, that's something we never even thought of when we put this together 5 years ago. So it's been a helpful and it's been a supportful thing for the kids.
Oh, they realize they're not alone as they
yes.
meet other kids. So, Judy, you alert the school each year of your granddaughter's circumstances. Why do you do that?
Well, I feel that truth is truth, and truth helps. And if the teachers know about the situation and the administration knows, everybody's on the same page, so that in case something does happen, they know there's a background here that's not your quote unquote normal background. And that, you know, everybody has problems, and it doesn't matter what kind of a family you come from, but at least all teachers have been extremely appreciative of being notified about things, because then they can do a better job, and they're treating my child. And I say, my child, we did adopt Michaela. It's worked out very, very well. In the beginning, when she was in elementary school, there was also a matter of safety, because we did not know what her father might do. He was kind of a loose screw. I don't know how else to say that nicely, but he really had problems. And we needed to notify not only the school, but the police. You're working under a lot of stress. The child is under stress. We're under stress. And with everybody knowing the same thing, it helps an awful lot.
How has adopting Michaela changed your relationship with your friends and, you know, the world you live in with adults?
Well, I think at this point in my life, the people who were my friends remain my friends, and they know the situation. You know, I can't do the same things that they can do, because you couldn't leave a small child and, you know, take off for Europe or whatever. It just didn't work. You would be, you know, abandoning. We had to be very careful about abandonment issues for her. So we didn't do the things that other people could do, which doesn't feel good. And certainly we didn't plan for, but this is a calling. And Linda keeps reminding all of us that not all parents, grandparents can do this or are willing to do it. And so, you know, your big yes, your big commitment also has little yeses along the way, and that includes your friends. And my friends understand, and they're extremely supportive. I don't have a slew of friends, but that's it's worked. And I'm very grateful for them. They have also done things to support us the best that they can without actually living the situation.
So you feel you have support, you have respite, and in case you need time for yourself.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I do. I mean, it's not, what can I say? Our particular child has been very easy. Mm. I don't know why, but that's just her personality. She came with a whole lot of wisdom. She's known us from day one. I was there. I saw her born. And we would keep her on weekends, even though we knew it was a difficult situation, and that she was in with her mother. Mm. And we waited for the right time to pull her out, because that's exactly what we had to do in order to save her life. And, you know, it's been a road.
Judy Dysock, grandmother participant in the Waukesha Support Group for Grandparents Providing Care. Linda Singer, licensed social worker, organizer of this group. You can join in the conversation, call in with questions and comments, 800-642-1234. Linda, you touched on that there are resources. There's assistance, financial assistance to grand families. What is available through either state or federal government?
Sure. Grandparents would be eligible, most situations would be eligible for kinship benefits. So it's a stipend. It's not, you're not going to fund a trip to Europe on it, obviously, but it's a help. It's a set amount of money. It's a rate that the state provides through the kinship program. The kids are eligible for insurance, Title 19 benefits. Grandparents often are eligible for some daycare assistance, and that's those benefits can be obtained through your local county government, and it's an application process. But those supports are real helpful on the financial end. And again, there are other resources available. We've connected our grandparents. Again, I said earlier, we have a monthly or bi-monthly speakers. So we pull in different presenters who can provide grandparents with legal information, community information, and different resources that will be a benefit for them. Mm-hmm. And but it's a matter of people need to know that those resources are available. Many grandparents have no clue, and they're just kind of struggling, and they really don't need to. So they need to seek assistance from their local county government.
Let's bring in Johanna in Marquette County. Johanna, hi.
Hi.
What would you like to bring up?
I'm just wondering if there's any resources for grandparents raising grandchildren in Marquette County. We used to have a group, but it's no longer available. And those of us who are older, trying to do the best job we can, are totally isolated. I have no one to talk to. And I'm 74, raising a five-year-old. So it's really a little bit difficult. And I'm just wondering, is there anything to support us when we have retirement? So I'm not eligible.
And I'm sorry to jump in here, Johanna. Linda, go ahead in the short amount of time we have. Go ahead.
Sure. I can tell you, I know it's difficult, certainly upstate. I've received calls from people wanting to be a part of our group virtually, and that's not something we can do. But Department of Family, Children and Family Services, they do offer programming for relative placements. And they do have some virtual meetings there are virtual meetings that are going on more so upstate. So if you go to the DCF website and look up relative support groups, kin support programs, there are resources on there. And I do know that there are some virtual groups because I referred some people upstate to some of those resources. I don't know how great they are, but it's an option.
They're there, yes.
Yep.
Linda and Judy, thank you for joining us. Linda Sanger, licensed social worker, organizer of Grandparents Raising Grandchildren Peer Support Group in Waukesha. Judy Dysock, grandmother raising her grandchild, part of the support group. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Wisconsin's Department of Health Services notes smoking is the number one preventable cause of death and disease in our country. We examine programs for quitting, the latest on vaping trends, and nationwide efforts to reduce tobacco use. You can be part of the discussion. Call in with a question. Share what's on your mind at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. We have clinical psychologist Danielle McCarthy, research director at the UW Center for Tobacco Research and Intervention. And Lorraine Lathan is here, directs the Wisconsin African American Tobacco Prevention Network. Danielle, vape manufacturers, they may argue their products work as an alternative for smokers on the path toward quitting. Does the research back up that claim?
The research does back up that claim in that there have been some randomized controlled trials that suggest that if you switch completely to an electronic cigarette or vaping delivery system for nicotine, that can work as well as, say, example, just using the nicotine patch. Work has not been done in the United States. It's been done in other countries, and we haven't been able to evaluate that here because right now the FDA does not allow us to test this as a therapy because no manufacturers have applied to make this a medication to help people stop smoking. So this is all based in other countries. The trick is that many people who start vaping do that in addition to using combustible tobacco, and that we believe is a net harm to health. Now you're administering nicotine in a couple different ways. You're continuing to use the more toxic combustible form of tobacco, and you may be increasing your level of tobacco dependence or your addiction to tobacco, which may make it harder to quit. So if you're going to use e-cigarettes, we encourage you to switch completely, to give up combustible tobacco completely, and to use the e-cigarettes for the purpose of quitting smoking, not to keep using nicotine in places where it's not possible or convenient to smoke regular cigarettes.
I wonder then, you know, if we see cigarette smoking in decline, is nicotine trending that way? I mean, considering the rise and availability of e-cigarettes and vaping, especially among youth.
Yeah, there have been concerning trends of increasing vaping, especially among youth. I hope that we've hit a peak and that we won't continue to climb, but it is a serious concern, and that's where we see the greatest growth. It's not in people who are quitting combustible tobacco, but in people who this is their first nicotine product that they're using.
Lorraine, this year the city of Milwaukee is implementing new zoning rules that limit expanding e-cigarette and tobacco stores. How could a change in zoning rules affect access to nicotine products?
Yes, we applaud the city for putting that ordinance in place. What it does, it prevents new license from being issued to potential retailers that are within 1,000 feet of a school, a playground, or a youth-serving organization, and those retailers that would be within 500 feet of another tobacco retailer. So that's a big win for us, and what it does, it reduces the opportunity for young people to access tobacco products.
Hmm. The research group, KFF, Lorraine, says African Americans in Wisconsin smoke at almost twice the rate of white residents. Why is there this difference? What is going on?
That's correct. Our rates are actually, we have the highest disparity in the nation in terms of tobacco use. And again, it goes back to the tactics of the tobacco industry. They have been targeting our community for decades and decades, and it's worked. And again, we know that tobacco is an addiction. Also, we know that more African Americans will attempt to quit and will not succeed. They will not be successful. And so we're really trying to hone in on what are those cessation programs that we can offer that, again, will lead to tobacco-free lifestyles for African Americans.
What do you recommend there? What nicotine replacement therapy is safe and effective?
What we're seeing is that a combination of counseling and nicotine replacement therapy, the two together, work well. Quite often that what we hear in our community is, oh, I'm just going to go cold turkey. I'm going to try to quit without any help. And that certainly is not the route to go. It's not a successful route. So we're really promoting, we promote the Wisconsin Quit Line. There's a first breath program for pregnant women who want to quit during their pregnancy and stay quit. And then, of course, there's some vaping programs. There's texting programs that are out there as well. I think we've worked a lot in public housing. Freedom from Smoking is another curriculum that has been developed by the American Lung Association. It's group counseling, and so along with the therapy. And the different nicotine replacement therapies, it differs in terms of what works for individuals, so that we really encourage them to talk to their medical provider to figure out which one's going to work best for them. But we do know that you need both. You need the counseling and you need the replacement therapy.
But I wonder, is the group counseling free and accessible to everyone, to people in rural and urban areas?
That's what we're working so hard on. Again, 1-800-QUIT-NOW is free and accessible. But we do know within our community, our culture, that people like the face-to-face type of counseling. So some of that counseling and services are available through healthcare providers. We're trying to get more information out there. And in fact, with the menthol ban being anticipated, the FDA is estimating about 230,000 African Americans nationwide will want to quit within the first 13 to 17 months that the ban goes into effect. And so as a result of that, we're starting to convene cessation providers here in Milwaukee so that we can have a very coordinated approach to how do we offer these services. And I would say similarly to when HUD went smoke-free in 2018, there was this concern that people were going to be evicted because they couldn't smoke in the common areas where they lived. And so we really worked hard. We worked with the American Lung Association to make programming, cessation programming, available to public housing residents in where they live. So we brought the programs to them. Yeah.
Lorraine Lathan, director of the Wisconsin African American Tobacco Prevention Network. Danielle McCarthy is here, research director at the UW Center for Tobacco Research and Intervention. As we look at smoking prevention and policy efforts across the state, you can join in with your questions and comments, 800-642-1234. Danielle, we heard from Larry in La Crosse, called in. Larry asks about the nicotine inhalation system, Nicotrol, and how effective it is to quit smoking compared to the use of e-cigarettes. And as an aside note, Nicotrol's maker Pfizer stopped selling the product as of September, according to a news release from Pfizer. Why was the product discontinued? What can you tell us?
So the nicotine inhaler was one of the evidence-based nicotine replacement therapies. You can replace nicotine from smoking in much safer ways by wearing a nicotine patch, using a nicotine gum or nicotine lozenge. There are prescription-only nicotine nasal sprays, and the nicotine inhaler was also prescription-only. And I think that the main reason it was discontinued is just that there was not a lot of use. It was not prescribed very frequently. It did allow people to sort of mimic the action of smoking, but it did not deliver a very high concentration of nicotine. And I think that it just didn't really hit the market in a very powerful way. And so it wasn't because it was dangerous in any way. It was just that there were other forms of nicotine replacement that people were using instead of the inhaler. But there was evidence to suggest that it was both safe and effective. So what we recommend currently is that as the first line treatment, if you're smoking regularly and you want to quit, is to combine the nicotine patch with a fast acting nicotine replacement agent, like the nicotine gum and the nicotine lozenge. And what that gets you is a slow, steady release of nicotine from the patch, and then the ability to give yourself a boost in nicotine when you're anticipating or experiencing a strong craving. And that combination nicotine replacement therapy is one of the more effective strategies that can roughly double the odds of quitting successfully, especially when combined with counseling, as Lorraine mentioned. The other first-line therapy that we recommend, which you have to get a prescription for, is varenicline, which is a non-nicotine pill that stimulates the nicotinic receptors and occupies them so that when you smoke while you're on it, you find smoking less rewarding. And so there are a couple of ways that that can help people. And again, that roughly doubles at least the odds of quitting successfully when combined with counseling. And what, I just want to, go ahead.
Well, what is the recovery trajectory? How long would you be on those frontline therapies?
So we typically recommend 8 to 12 weeks, 12 weeks being the more common. We do encourage people to stick with it for those 12 weeks, even when things are going really well, because relapse risk remains high for quite some time. It does start to fall after 3 months, though. And so we encourage people to stick with the medications and to get counseling. And as Lorraine mentioned, the Wisconsin Tobacco Quit Line does provide free counseling in multiple forms throughout Wisconsin. All Wisconsin residents are able to use this service to get one-on-one counseling with an experienced quit coach, to enroll in a text messaging program, or to even do virtual support groups that happen online. They have a bunch of digital tools available now as well, and the Wisconsin Tobacco Quit Line will send you a starter kit of nicotine patch, gum, or lozenge, so you can try it out, all at no cost. And so we want people to know that this service is available. They also have a vaping cessation program for people who may be struggling to stop vaping and want some support in doing that.
What have you observed from the advent of virtual support groups?
So I think it's an exciting way to connect people. People often voice interest in joining support groups, but then the logistics of life kind of get in the way, right? It becomes hard to show up Tuesday night at 6 o'clock, right, to a group meeting. And I think the idea of being able to connect with peers who are going through the same thing and teach each other what works is a great idea. And if being able to do that remotely would allow more people in rural areas to participate, or people with transportation or childcare issues, I think it's fantastic.
Clinical psychologist Danielle McCarthy is a research director at the UW Center for Tobacco Research and Intervention. Lorraine Lathan heads up the Wisconsin African American Tobacco Prevention Network, and there's space to talk. Call in with a question. You can add your views. The number is 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Smokers can and do quit smoking for good. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention likens quitting to a marathon, not a sprint. Call in to ask a question. Share what's on your mind. The number is 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Danielle McCarthy is a research director at the UW Center for Tobacco Research and Intervention. And Lorraine Lathan directs the Wisconsin African American Tobacco Prevention Network. Lorraine, you mentioned cold turkey and just stopping smoking, as they say, all with willpower. What is the potential for success or failure from that perspective?
I think Danielle might actually have the percentages. I can just share with you that we encourage people. We hear cold turkey and we hear prayer and just praying. And we encourage, again, our participants, again, to enter into a program. Yes, continue to pray, but also group counseling and some type of quit aid is what we recommend. But I think, Danielle, she might have the percentages. It's very low, but she might have the actual percentages.
Danielle, stopping without other support, what do you find?
Right. So the quit rate for a single quit attempt at the population level is somewhere between 5% and 7% of people will succeed in staying quit. And medications and counseling, the combination will increase that. Now, at the same time, right, that's kind of discouraging that only 5 to 7 out of 100 people who try to quit will stay quit for 6 months. If we look at the whole trajectory of a person's career in quitting smoking, we know that more than half the people who've ever smoked have succeeded in quitting. You can quit. It just takes trying lots of things and trying many times. And each try counts. Each try count, each attempt can teach you something about what you need to change, what you need to try, what your triggers are, and how to deal with them. And believing that you can do it is one of the biggest obstacles, I think, that people experience. And hoping that sort of it will go away on its own, that doesn't work. And so we encourage people to try lots of things, see what fits for them, and build on their past success. Even if you only quit for a day, that's a beginning.
Lorraine, how can people best support friends and family members who are attempting to quit?
I think the best thing they can do is not to judge them and to, again, as Danielle said, every attempt counts. It matters. And so if there's relapse, people can encourage them to try again. Well, that didn't work, so let's try this particular method. Another way that family and friends can support someone who's trying to quit is to make sure that they help that person understand what are the triggers for them smoking and to help them to avoid those triggers. Quite often we know that stress, just kind of all of the stress related to job, family, kids, that smoking allows for some type of relief. So what are some substitute activities that can be offered for someone who's trying to quit? Going for a walk, spending time with family, and just avoiding the triggers is a big battle or challenge for people who are trying to quit. So again, I would encourage someone, if you have a loved one who's trying to quit, help them. Help you yourself should understand what their triggers are and then help them to avoid those triggers.
Danielle, what is your message for family and friends?
So think of this as your loved one having COVID or the flu for several weeks, right? Be patient with them. They're going to go through withdrawal, and that withdrawal may come out as irritability, sadness, anxiety. It may be unpleasant for a little while, but if you give them your support, if you let them know you believe they can do it and you support them in making this change in their for their health and the health of the people that love them, then you know they have a better chance of doing that. We do know that social support does predict success in quitting. And so be loving, be supportive, and be patient.
But I want to pick up on that word social, because there is a social habit to smoking and tobacco use as well. Perhaps, you know, one you do with friends or step outside and have a cigarette together. How do you replace that social aspect of it?
Right. I think that it is important that people not give up the things that smoking has been giving them. They just find other ways to get that. So you also miss out on a lot socially when you're the only one in your group who's going out for a smoke break every 30 minutes. And so you can find ways to find new social rewards and opportunities that you've previously missed because you're investing not in smoking, but in other relationships and connections. And most people are able to identify people in their lives who will celebrate that they're trying to quit smoking and be proud and happy for them. And so those are the people you want to spend a little more time with.
Lorraine, looking at the state of Wisconsin, your organization promoting the Wisconsin Healthiest State Initiative, where are we now as a state on the path to becoming healthier?
I think, again, the fact that we're smoking less, that the tobacco adult smoking rate has certainly declined, that's putting us closer to the path of being one of the healthier states or healthiest states in the United States. I think that the problem lies in the disparities, that the successes that we're achieving in improving health outcomes, they're not equally achieved by all, across all populations. So that's where we really have to focus on the disparities that exist.
Yes, yes. Well, Danielle and Lorraine, thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate it.
Thank you
for having us.
Danielle McCarthy is a clinical psychologist and research director at the UW Center for Tobacco Research and Intervention that is based at UW-Madison. Lorraine Lathan is director of the Wisconsin African American Tobacco Prevention Network. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The American Heart Association estimates we consume around 60 pounds of added sugar each year. And they put it another way. That's the size of 6 bowling balls weighing 10 pounds each. We go deeper on the world's largest crop with help from a new investigative podcast series. And you can be part of the discussion. Call in with a question or comments, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Celeste Headlee is a journalist and host of Big Sugar. It's a podcast from iHeartMedia and Imagine Entertainment, delving into the multi-billion dollar sugar industry. Celeste, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
Your podcast, telling the story of sugarcane production on American soil and through decades, why is this story so important, so relevant to share today?
Well, The main reason is that the Farm Bill is up for reconsideration this year, which is a massive, massive piece of legislation most people don't pay a lot of attention to. And it only comes up for reconsideration every 4 years. And the sugar program is a multi-billion dollar piece of the Farm Bill. And so this is the moment when we need to reconsider the sugar industry and whether it's worth billions of our tax dollars.
What are the subsidies and the profits like for sugar growers? What's at stake in the Farm Bill?
So these sugar subsidies were put into place decades ago as part of the effort during the World War, when they were concerned that we might have to rely on sugar from other countries and then not have enough sugar. It has been obviously quite a long time since we had to worry about that as a nation, but the sugar subsidies are still in there, which basically guarantees sugar growers a certain price for the sugar. It incentivizes companies to grow sugar. So they are getting billions of dollars to grow sugar. As I mentioned, it is worth billions to a very small number of sugar companies that are owned by a small number of basically people, families in many cases. And yet our sugar in the United States costs more to the American consumer than it does in almost every other developed nation. So taxpayers are paying for sugar in a number of ways, and I'm sure it will come out over the course of this conversation. We're also paying for it in healthcare and the environment, but just through the sugar program in the Farm Bill, our sugar is very expensive indeed.
You had aha moments throughout this investigation. What surprised you most after investigating the sugar industry?
I think, number one, I don't think I realized just how hard it is and always has been to get sugar to our tables. Mm-hmm. I don't think I really, really took that in. Hearing the stories of these Jamaican workers, you know, cutting sugar cane, which is mostly done now using machines in the United States, but it's still cut by hand in many other places. Hearing these Jamaican workers talk about what they went through, because American workers were not going to do it. And so these companies would bring in immigrant workers through our migrant worker programs to cut it, and them talking about what they went through, it was kind of horrifying, frankly.
Using machetes?
Yeah, they would be in armor because the machetes were so sharp that if you make a mistake, you're standing there in the hot Florida, Louisiana sun all day long for 8 hours, and you're expected to cut 8 tons of cane. And I don't know, Kate, if you've ever had your hands on a cane.
Mm. I used to live in Louisiana, and there were
fields all around. These massive plants, right? Sometimes they grow way above your head.
Yes.
They are thick. Some of them take both your hands to get around them. They feel like wood, like they are thick. Mm. And so these machetes are incredibly sharp. They can easily cut straight through your flesh and into bone. They're wearing armor. It becomes this just rote robotic movement for these men. So you can imagine what that does to your body over the course of a day of doing this same movement. I mean, just the description of what happened and the injuries that occurred, and they would get short periods of a break for lunch where they would get maybe a bowl with rice and perhaps some beans in it. They didn't get a break for water. You know, putting a spoonful of sugar into my coffee in the morning, I didn't make that connection.
We're talking about the multi-billion dollar sugar industry through the decades. Celeste Headley, host of the podcast called Big Sugar. You can join in with your questions, share your concerns at 800-642-1234. Celeste, your podcast stems from the 1980s book called Big Sugar and a 2001 investigation by Vanity Fair. What has changed since these decades-old investigations? I mean, you mentioned technology changes, and, you know, I would imagine, too, there are now, sugar harvesters and farm implements that we're not having to do this by hand.
That is one thing that has changed. And at least in the United States, they are using sugar harvesters. The United States is one of the top five producers of sugar in the world. The other four big producers, like China and other places, still often harvest by hand, though. Mm. Some other things really have not changed all that much. I got to be honest with you. Much of the sugar industry looks exactly the same way that it did 20 years ago when Marie was writing this piece about the landmark court case, this massive court case in which these Jamaican workers were trying to get back the wages that were stolen from them, and they were not successful in doing so. You know, the sugar industry goes back, obviously, hundreds of years. It is not possible to separate the sugar industry from slave labor because it is so labor intensive. Even though the harvesters themselves has been mechanized, sugar is still a labor intensive industry. It still requires a massive number of people to work those harvesters, to get it to the processing plants, to get it into bags. Every step along the way still requires a large number of people, and that will continue to be the truth for a long period of time.
A research fellow you interviewed for Slate magazine says the industry is similar to a cartel. Is that an accurate description?
Yeah, that was a research fellow with the Cato Institute called on the candy-coated cartel. I mean, obviously, that's not a one-to-one comparison. Yeah, you know, obviously that's metaphoric. But in terms of the fact that there's this massive amount of secrecy, that this is the power of this industry is... that is incredible, that they pull levers of power that I think most of us are not aware. Let me give you an example. And this is a story that we tell in the podcast that Marie Brenner told in her original Vanity Fair article 20 years ago. So when Bill Clinton was still president, at one point he was breaking up with Monica Lewinsky and telling her it was over. And he had told his aides he did not want to be disturbed, and he was in the Oval Office. And a call comes through on his phone, and he said, "I didn't want to be disturbed." And the aide says, "Mr. President, it's Alfie von Huel," who was one of the CEOs of U.S. Sugar. And the president says, "I'll take that call." That's how powerful these sugar barons are, and they always have been. They have manipulated not just politics through the incredible wealth they use, but science, environmental policy, real estate. I mean, when you talk about a cartel, it's mass. The influence on our lives, our labor policy, our wages, it's massive. It's incredible the way it has influenced the way that we live.
Celeste Headley hosts an investigative podcast series. It's called Big Sugar, focusing on the multi-billion-dollar sugar industry and the forces within it. You can join the conversation with your question, share concerns at any point. The number is 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Sugar can be found in foods we eat every day, and a new investigative podcast examines the industry's political power, its treatment of sugarcane harvesters, and public health effects of eating too much sugar. You can add a question or share at any point in the discussion. Call 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Journalist Celeste Headley is host of Big Sugar and stays with us. Let's bring in Jane in Oconomowoc. Jane, hi. What is your question?
Hi, good morning. I lived in southwestern Minnesota for several years, and there is one crop there is sugar beets. And I'm wondering if you can speak to the influence of the sugar beet crop on the sugar industry, and if that has made any difference in workers and how they're treated. And because the cooperative in the city where I lived, the town rather, where I lived, was the main employer.
Jane, thank you for that question. Neighboring Minnesota producing roughly one third of all sugar beets in America. Celeste, what can you say there about the role of sugar beets?
Yeah, I mean, sugar beets produce a significant portion of sugar in the United States. I think somewhere around 35% or so, still over half, 65% or so comes from sugarcane in the United States. But, the sugarcane producers don't have to worry about sugar beets because of the Farm Bill. Just to go back to that, remember, they are protected from any competition because our government literally pays them to plant sugar. It guarantees them a price for sugar. In order to force the sugar industry, big sugar, to have to compete in a fair market, we would have to kill the sugar program, which, this is one of the reasons we did this podcast this year, is to encourage people who want to have their voices known to think about possibly where $2 to $4 billion of taxpayer money could be spent if it weren't going to pay sugar barons to plant sugar. What other things could we spend that on, and call their representatives? Because yeah, they're being paid, so they don't have to worry about sugar beet producers.
Why is the sugar industry have so much political sway, so much savvy and pull in Washington? Why is that?
Because they're so wealthy. I mean, imagine for a moment that you have this product that everybody wants, right? And you're still also being paid to sell this product. And you're making money coming and going. They're very, very wealthy. They have a lot of money. And so they spread it around, and they're quite savvy politically in that if you go and look at the political donations made by many of these sugar producers, they're not donating to one party. They're donating very liberally, lowercase l, to both parties. And so they become important donors across the board. They don't just get a Democratic president on the phone. They get a Republican on the phone as well. They are important to both parties, to all parties. That's what makes them so very important. And so both of the political parties are willing to protect their interests. They also often make the case when it comes to the Farm Bill, they make this case that they are farmers, they make this sentimental appeal that, we're American farmers and we should protect American farmers. And, I would think most people don't, that's not what they think of when we think about, a small time family American farmer, but they're quite good at making that case. So when it all comes down though, to is just billions of dollars.
And then why is it, though, that sugarcane producing farmers get these subsidies, whereas in our parts where sugar beets are produced, those farmers aren't getting the same types of subsidies?
Yeah, it all just goes back to the origins of that sugar subsidy, going back to the war era when, there was concern that was still at the time when we did not have an obesity crisis. They felt that sugar was necessary for energy, that they needed to keep not just soldiers, but all the people working on in the factories going. They needed energy. They needed to make sure everyone was working at their best. That required sugar. And they were afraid that they would run out of sugar. And so they wanted to protect that industry. They wanted to protect that commodity. And so they put subsidies in there to make sure that farmers would always have a guaranteed price for sugar. And it is a relic of that time, basically, because every single time the Farm Bill came up for reauthorization, the sugar producers would lavish donations on politicians and they would vote to reauthorize that sugar subsidy. It's still there.
Celeste Headley, host of the podcast Big Sugar, you can join in with your questions about the sugar industry, 800-642-1234. Ernest in Hayward now. Ernest, what is your question?
I've read a lot about the subsidies of corn in the state of Florida that have polluted and caused destruction to the wetlands in Florida. And then there's the corn subsidies, too, giving us high fructose corn syrup, which is contaminated groundwater and our own health and groundwater in the dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico through the use of synthetic fertilizers and pesticides. So, but Florida is really, really a basket case because of the corn subsidies down there.
Ernest, thank you. What are the environmental realities in growing sugar, in growing these crops, Celeste?
Yeah, it's pretty devastating to the environment, and it's partly because the regulations are not there. And again, this is because of wielding political influence to avoid having those regulations put on their industry means that the industry has been dumping chemical fertilizers and pesticides straight into the marsh. The Everglades have now been polluted by phosphorus, not just in Florida, but as you know, in Louisiana as well, nitrogen, mercury, that's caused some really devastating algae blooms. A lot of the natural plants and animals have died. There also is an incredible amount of air pollution. Why? Because the cheapest way to get rid of the stubs of cane is to simply burn them. So they burn almost 500,000 acres of sugarcane for 6 to 8 months out of the year. And there's a lot of critters that don't make it out, that simply die in these fires. And so instead of doing a more environmentally safe way of refreshing those fields, they just burn them down because they're not required to do anything else. You know, part of the podcast, we went down and visited some of these fields. We parked at one point in an elementary school, and it was right next door to one of these sugarcane fields where they were burning. Mm. And I stepped out of the car, and in less than a minute, I was covered in this thick ash. And I looked to my right, and all of the playground equipment was just coated in thick black ash.
Mm.
Yeah.
How water intensive is this crop?
That's another thing. It also requires a great deal of water as well. You know, sugarcane, often if you go down to a sugar field, and again, you have seen this before, it sometimes is in standing water.
Mm-hmm.
For the environment, it is a very cost intensive crop in every possible way. The problem is that every single time people have tried to take even the smallest steps to try and put regulations on to force the industry to tiny little bits, right? How they truck their products, how they transport things. It's been over tens of millions of dollars end up going, and then it gets defeated. Mm. There was an attorney general in Florida that filed a lawsuit, which I think is still ongoing at this point, which there have been lawsuits filed before. The Everglades Health Foundation has tried. They've tried through the Army Corps of Engineers to
Multiple ways. Yes. Celeste Headley, we're going to pause here, host of the investigative podcast series Big Sugar, looking at how industry practices affect our world. You can join in 800-642-1234. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.
live from.
It is the morning show. I'm Kay Darcher-Kent. The agricultural lobby, the American Sugar Alliance, it says sugar is an essential ingredient in our nation's food supply, made from two different crops we've been talking about, sugar beets and sugar cane. A new investigative podcast exposes harsh worker conditions in sugarcane production and the power of this industry. Call in with a question or comment at any point, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Journalist Celeste Headley is host of the podcast series called Big Sugar. Celeste, we heard from Linda in Appleton who called in, and Linda is wondering about the pushback you received from the sugar industry because of this podcast. How did the American Sugar Alliance respond?
They had a couple responses. The first is they felt we were focusing on a 20-year-old case, which is true. Part of the story we tell is about a class action lawsuit that began 20 years ago. That's true. But we bring the story obviously up to present times. The other thing is that they talk about the number of people that they employ, that they're an important part of American business. What you just said, that sugar is a part of people's diets and they rely on us and they're a good part of American capitalist business. So all those things are true. They employ a lot of people. They are a corporate member of American society. No argument here.
Let's talk about the court case following lawyers who filed this class action lawsuit in the 80s over millions of dollars in lost wages for sugarcane cutters. And let's listen to lawyer Edward Tuddenham on his discovery that workers weren't receiving their promised wages.
You had to cut over a ton and a half per hour, and people just couldn't do it. People clearly were not cutting fast enough. They just couldn't, physically could not. I don't care whether you're an Olympic champion, you cannot cut cane that fast.
So what happened with this court case?
Some of the sugar producers settled. There was one sugar company that did not, and we focus on the two brothers that owned that company, two men born in Cuba who fled to the United States after Castro took over, the Funhuls. And that ended up being a very long, drawn-out case. Essentially, in the first time they went to court, the judge immediately issued them a ruling in their favor, a massive ruling in their favor, and they appealed. And then it ended up getting drawn out over years and years and years. And in the end, well, I don't want to tell you, let people listen, but the workers don't get their lost wages. Let me just say that. And this is something that all Americans, frankly, we should feel ashamed for. I mean, these workers literally gave their blood to get sugar onto our tables, and we did not treat them well. And they were earning very, very, very little, and their employers stole some of that from them. But I think, you know, one of the reasons we needed to go back to retell this case is because, A, we needed to update it with what has happened since. But also, it's really important to understand the sugar industry's place in labor history in the United States, its place in immigration history, because it really had a lot of influence on our government's attitude toward migrant workers and the policies that are still in place today. And, you know, what happens? Because if one of those workers were not up to par, according to their employers, if they got injured, if they weren't cutting enough cane or working hard enough, the threat was always there that they would simply deport them. You know, that gave them an amount of power, which is just that's a lot of power. But they also had them in just very dire conditions, the places where they were had them living and forcing them to pay for their food and these rooms. It was just awful.
The Von Hul family, the maker of Domino Sugar, and you know, I think about my own complicity. I mean, I put my sugar cube just a couple hours ago, my Domino sugar cube, into my Earl Grey tea. How do we reconcile with this, Celeste?
So I have not been able to. First I tried to go without sugar. And which was very difficult and over time became impossible for me. It's not impossible. And there's gotta be people who call in and say, I am now without sugar, and I tip my hat to you because it's hard. It's very hard. They put sugar in a lot of things. By the way, Domino Sugar is also CNH Sugar. It's Florida Crystals. It's Red Path. They own a lot of things. I found the Wholesome Sugar Company. They are not part of these big sugar companies. Hmm. It's really difficult. I mean, I think, you know, the thing of it is, Kate, is there's so much in life that is when you pull back the curtain, there's ugliness behind it. And it's almost too much for your average human being to bear. And so it's impossible for all of us to have to bear that burden for everything in our lives. I mean, it's too much, but the time has come for sugar, right? Like, there was a reckoning for tobacco. There's the beginning of a reckoning for this pharmaceutical industry, and it's time for sugar to have its reckoning. And we do have to bear this for a moment. It's time for us to think about how that sugar is getting to our table and to come up with a better solution.
Celeste Headley with us, host of the investigative podcast series Big Sugar, as we look at the multi-billion-dollar sugar industry over time. And you can join in at any point. Call in with a question. Share your concerns at 800-642-1234. Celeste, you were going here for just a bit, but Lynn from Wausau called in and is wondering if there are more ethical ways for us consumers to buy and use sugar. And Lynn asks, is beet sugar, for instance, more ethical to use than cane sugar?
No, it is not, I'm afraid. It also is not environmentally safe. Some of the companies that I've been talking about also own a great number of beet fields. So you have to actually do the research on the company itself. I ended up tracking down, like I was talking about, the Wholesome Sugar Company, mm-hmm. which I'm a journalist. I don't know the people who own Wholesome, mm-hmm. but I did my own research on them. They launched in 2001, and they were a fair trade company, and they have consciously sourced ingredients that are also in keep an eye toward climate change. So you have to do your own research and find them. In terms of sugar, that's one of the few, it's not the only, believe me, but you have to do your own research to find somebody who is producing it in an ethical way, and it's gonna cost you a little more. You can try to replace it with honey. That's not gonna work in all of your baking. But it's so hard. And the other thing about this that makes it so difficult is because the sugar industry has been remarkably successful in getting sugar into so many parts of our food items that it does not belong in. It's in beef jerky. It's in vitamins. It's in some toothpaste. It's in bread. It's in so many things. And if you think it's not, that's partially because there are so many names for sugar that you do not recognize. In fact, if you go and Google it, you will find people who have collected all the many different names for sugar that sugar has, and that is that those lists are dozens of names long because it's updated all the time. And I had to print those lists out and keep them in my kitchen when I was trying to eliminate sugar, because you will not recognize sometimes that sugar is in your food until you realize that it's named something entirely different.
Does the industry come up with those names?
Oftentimes they do, yes. And it's a way of adding sugar into these other products. You don't know the sugar is in there, but it is just sugar. And so you don't know that this is a Domino's food brand sugar that's in your sugar. And so you're buying a product from Alfie and Pepe Van Hool without even realizing it. It's so difficult. And it feels insidious.
Celeste Headley, journalist, host of a new podcast series examining the power of the sugar industry. Call in with the question, share your concerns, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A new investigative podcast series examines exploitations in the multi-billion-dollar sugar industry through decades and the political influence sugar businesses have today. As we explore the podcast called Big Sugar, call in with a question, add a comment, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Journalist and podcast host Celeste Headley stays with us. Celeste, turning to sugar in the diet, consuming excess sugar can increase the risk of serious health conditions, including type 2 diabetes. How has the sugar industry marketed the nutritional benefits of sugar?
Well, much like we saw with the tobacco industry in terms of revelations about how they influenced the science, the same sort of revelations have occurred with sugar. Essentially, research has uncovered the fact that the sugar industry really impacted what we know about sugar, and especially its influence on our cardiovascular system. And this has been pretty recent. Listeners may realize this because for a very, very long period of time, the sugar industry pressured doctors to blame fat for not just obesity, but all kinds of cardiovascular problems, heart problems and heart attacks. And so, you know, you'd go to the store and you'd see a box of licorice and it would say fat free. And so, you know, people would eat things with all kinds of sugar. I saw this ad for sugar that said, if sugar caused obesity, why are there so few fat kids? Because they eat so much sugar, right? One dentist that we talked to was researching sugar for a number of reasons. And she ended up finding the archives of a sugar company that had gone out of business. And, you know, a librarian had the archives of this sugar company. Nobody was really paying attention. These were all confidential documents. And so she found all these confidential memos in which there was the receipts, right? They were revealing how they wanted to influence the medical and scientific information on the effect of sugar. But it goes back even further with the story of two scientists, John Yudkin and then Ansel Keys, who basically kind of personify this battle between sugar and fat in terms of our health, in which John Yudkin, a guy who grew up in a very poor Jewish Orthodox family in Britain, was studying the effect of excessive sugar and found it absolutely led in a direct line to coronary heart disease. And Ansel Keys, whose research was being funded by the sugar industry, spent his life really trying to completely discredit Dr. Yudkin and succeeded in doing so. And Ansel Keys became a rock star scientist. He was on all the talk shows. He became quite wealthy. And since then, John Yudkin's research has been absolutely upheld. He has, since his death, been enjoyed his book, Pure, White, and Deadly, has enjoyed a second run of popularity. And it's turned out that he was right all along. So, yeah, it, for a very, very long period of time, our eyes were not opened to the danger of sugar. And now we know. That we were eating too much.
You mentioned how the sugar industry had paid scientists in the 1960s to downplay the link between sugar and heart disease. And JAMA Internal Medicine had published those internal sugar industry documents in recent years, in 2016, really shifting the blame to saturated fat. Fast forward to the present. Are there still issues now in influencing nutrition science?
Yeah, and I assume that what you're asking me this because of the recent report that came out saying that aspartame may be really, really dangerous. Mm-hmm. And of course, a large number of American scientists stepped forward immediately and said, absolutely not. There's no evidence for this. And many of them immediately said, we suspect the sugar industry is influencing this report. There was no evidence of this. Aspartame has been cleared again and again and again. But the truth is that every single time a sugar substitute starts to enjoy popularity, there is some sort of, I hate to say fear-mongering. As a journalist, it always gives me hives to use that. But yeah, there's always some kind of fear-mongering brought up. And there's really not a lot of evidence showing that. For when aspartame first came on the market, there were some very sketchy research studies claiming that it caused cancer. And it kept a lot of people from using aspartame for a long time. And it turns out those research studies have been discredited and debunked. But because the reaction with studies, research that was funded in large part by the sugar industry was quick, incisive, and highly publicized, it worked its magic. And it made people wary of using aspartame. And there's always this concern when there's a sugar substitute that it's going to happen again.
Talking about the sugar industry with Celeste Headley, host of the investigative podcast series Big Sugar. You can join in with your question, your insights, 800-642-1234. Celeste, in your reporting, did you see situations at all of any child labor violations? What could you tell us there?
I did not. Okay. Many of the places which you have seen recently reports of that happening were not the places where we were going. We were mostly in Florida. And as I mentioned, the fields in Florida have been largely mechanized. So I did not. We had heard reports from people who have worked in some of the factories in which child labor has been an issue, but that was all secondhand.
In terms of the sugar that is imported then to our country, should we be concerned about child labor in other countries as we eat the sugar? Because as you mentioned, this family, the Fungul family, has sugar under a lot of different names and corporations.
Yes, we absolutely always have to be. The largest sugar producing countries in the world are the United States, as I mentioned, also Brazil, India, and Thailand and China. Sugar is a major crop, especially for Thailand, and that includes sugar produced from both sugar cane and from sugar beets. And yes, there is real issues for child labor in several of those countries. And there are a number of organizations, including the United Nations, that keep track of violations of child labor laws. And look, it's difficult for the average person to keep track of this. I don't expect everybody to do all this homework themselves. It's one of the reasons why, for me, I find it better to go and find the companies that are certified by an organization like Fair Trade Certified, et cetera, and let the a certification organization that does that homework for you, an organization that you trust like that, let them do the homework, because, you know, life is hard. Most of us have too much to do already.
And that recipe calls for a cupful of sugar, meanwhile.
Exactly. I mean, if you're making something from scratch and that's why you need that sugar, let somebody else do that work for you.
As you watch Capitol Hill and the Farm Bill coming together and the tensions around it, what movement is there in removing sugar subsidies from the Farm Bill in the future? What do you see?
There has not been a lot. And, you know, this is one of the things where one of the reasons why we wanted to make sure that this podcast came out this year, why I have been doing as many interviews like this one as I possibly can, is to encourage everyone to call their congressperson, to call their representatives, because normally the Farm Bill gets talked about with these warm, glowing speeches about American farmers, and it gets rubber stamped. And so I would really love to see that not happen this year. At least let there be some debate about the sugar program and perhaps some of the other things that go into the Farm Bill. We're talking about a Farm Bill which all together includes trillions of dollars of taxpayer money. And again, we are in a period of time in which we're being told as taxpayers that there are some things that we find important and a value that we don't have money for. And maybe we should be thinking more critically and more intentionally about where that money is going.
Celeste, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Celeste Headley is a journalist and host of the investigative podcast series called Big Sugar. We have a link at WPR.org/mornings. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.